permanently in community control, does that mean the police precinct won't return? And what does this mean? 15 seconds.
Well, I think the police and the establishment will make every attempt to bring the police back, but we are demanding that the East Precinct be taken permanently into community control and be converted to socially constructive purposes, not for the police to oppress people.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, Kshama Savant, Socialist City Council member in Seattle. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now!'s general manager is Julie Crosby. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tay Maria Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Massoud. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Say, say.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, COVID-19 strikes people of color at a much higher rate in Multnomah County as the county prepares to reopen tomorrow. Portland police have been allowed to cover their badge numbers during recent protests, and dismantling a dam in Washington State, how it could help salmon and orcas in the Pacific Northwest. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 18th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. New COVID-19 cases are still in the triple digits today. A new order on face coverings covers the state's most populous counties, and new COVID-19 cases are striking people of color at a much higher rate. KBOO's Annette Newell has these stories in today's local COVID-19 update.
COVID-19 has killed four more people in Oregon, two of them in Marion County and two in Clackamas County, raising the state's death toll to 187. Oregon reported 148 new confirmed and presumptive cases today in 16 counties. Those with the highest numbers are Multnomah with 33, Marion with 26, Washington with 25, Umatilla with 13, and Clackamas with 12. Oregon now has a state total of confirmed and presumptive cases of COVID-19 rising to 6,366. Despite the recent surge in coronavirus cases, Multnomah County has the green light from the governor to begin its Phase 1 reopening on Friday, June 19th. The reopening tomorrow will allow businesses that serve the public, such as restaurants and beauty salons, to reopen as long as they can comply with state health and safety guidelines to prevent COVID-19 spread. Face masks will be required while in indoor public spaces in Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas, Hood River, Marion, Polk, and Lincoln counties beginning Wednesday, June 24th. Governor Brown announced the reopening Wednesday, just 6 days after pausing all applications due to a statewide jump in COVID-19 cases. Multnomah County has seen a recent uptick in cases, but Governor Brown plans to continue with reopening plans, saying that the county has not experienced a rise in coronavirus hospitalizations and that the number of hospitalizations was well within capacity. But that was later corrected since the county has had an increase in hospitalizations, but the overall rate is still low. Multnomah County leaders say they recognize that people of color are the most likely to be exposed to the virus at work and to get seriously ill or die from the coronavirus. They say they did not see the stage one reopening as a return to business as usual, and they're encouraging everyone in the community to maintain social distancing and wear face coverings. They say they have started extra testing and advisories in an effort to protect African American, Latino, and Indigenous residents and other people of color. Many businesses have pushed to allow the limited reopening, which the governor already approved to all the other 35 Oregon counties since May and early June. Under Phase 1, restaurants, bars, hair salons, gyms, and other personal service businesses can reopen, and gatherings can increase to 25 people. Dr. Jennifer Vines, the lead county health officer, says she expects COVID-19 cases to go up. Without a vaccine or treatment, she says this is the new stay-home order to maintain that 6 feet of distancing and the face coverings. The county's most recent batch of health indicators showed a huge spike in cases among people of color. They were 15 times as likely as white Multnomah County residents to test positive for the coronavirus for the week ending June 5th. Annette Newell for the KBOO Evening News.
Public records show that Portland police officers have been allowed to hide their badge numbers during protests. The Oregonian reports that former police chief Jamie Resch, who resigned last week after public outrage about police brutality, told officers they could cover their badge numbers with tape displaying their city personnel ID number. According to the PPB, the move was an effort to protect officers by keeping their identities from the public in order to prevent potential retaliation or harassment. According to the report, not all officers have been covering their name tags, but some officers at the Justice Center have been covering their badge numbers with tape that has their personnel number written on it. The decision raises alarms among civil rights advocates who say covering badge numbers can prevent police accountability during protests, because officers won't be identifiable. This criticism follows recent reports of police brutality against Portland-based journalists, incidents that were criticized by the mayor. A spokesperson for the police says the Bureau was ensuring the safety of officers and their families and noted that officers could be identified internally using the personnel ID number. The Portland City Council approved a $15 million budget cut to the Portland Police Bureau on Wednesday. On its second attempt to revise the police budget in response to ongoing protests against police brutality and racism, the council passed the city budget 3-1. The decision will reduce the police budget to $229 million a year. While significant, this number falls well below the $50 million cut demanded by many protesters and advocates. The vote came after 20 consecutive days of protests and broad public demand for reform. Hundreds of Portland residents demanded cuts at budget hearings. Thousands of emails were sent to city officials, and a protest outside Mayor Ted Wheeler's apartment was organized by the advocacy group Care Not Cops. The one vote no was from Commissioner Chloe Udaly, who said the cuts weren't enough, pointing out that many citizens demanded as much as $50 million in budget cuts. The new budget, developed by Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, will reallocate those funds to support Black and other marginalized communities. The cuts will include the removal of patrol officers in Portland Public Schools, the disbanding of the Gun Violence Reduction Team and Transit Police Division. Commissioner Hardesty says the budget cuts are only the beginning of a more deep and meaningful police reform. A former Atlanta police officer was charged with felony murder Wednesday after shooting a Black man outside of a Wendy's restaurant last week. KBOO's Melissa Hood has more on the story.
Former Atlanta police officer Garrett Wolf faces 11 charges, including murder and aggravated assault, in connection with the shooting of 27-year-old Rayshard Brooks. According to authorities, the incident took place on Friday night after the police were called to an Atlanta Wendy's restaurant where Brooks had fallen asleep in his car in the drive-thru line. After failing a sobriety test, the officers began to arrest Brooks, who, after a short struggle, grabbed one of the officers' tasers and started to run away. A video of the shooting that has been circulating in the media shows Wolf shooting at a fleeing Brooks in the parking lot of the Wendy's. Prosecutors said during a news conference on Wednesday that Rolfe declared, quote, "I got him," after firing at Brooks and kicked the victim after he fell to the ground. Paul L. Howard Jr., the Fulton County District Attorney, said Rolfe and his partner, David Brosnan, failed to render aid to Brooks after he was shot. Officer Brosnan was charged with 3 counts, including aggravated assault and violations of oath, and has been placed on administrative duty. Howard said during the conference that Brooks cooperated with the police for more than 40 minutes and was not informed that he would be arrested for driving under the influence, which is a violation of the police department's policy. Officials from the union International Brotherhood of Police Officers denounced the charges against both officers as premature and politically motivated. A spokesman for the police department said later Wednesday that a significant number of officers had called out and not come in to work their evening shifts as a show of disapproval for the charges against the officers. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Melissa Hood.
Oregon Senator Ron Wyden is urging Congress to pass the Equality Act to protect LGBTQ Americans against discrimination. Here's what he had to say on the floor of the U.S. Senate.
President, before she leaves, another good idea from Senator Stabenow. Pass the Equality Act today. Too logical, I guess, but it's another good idea, and I thank my colleague for it. I also want to commend my partner from Oregon, Senator Merkley, who's been leading this fight for years now, and Wisconsin often partners with Oregon, going all the way back to our shared ownership of Wayne Morris. And I just want to thank my colleagues for the great work they've been doing, and just take a couple of minutes to talk about my pride in standing with them to fight for the passage of the Equality Act. We've come together during the middle of Pride Month, and in 2020, with a pandemic continuing to spread, Pride Month looks a little different than it has in the past. No parades, smaller celebrations. But it still has been a historic month when it comes to LGBTQ rights, perhaps more so than any other since marriage equality became the law of the land in June 2015. A few days ago, the Supreme Court ruled that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 protects LGBTQ Americans against discrimination in the workplace. The majority said an employer who fires an individual merely for being gay or transgender defies the law. Now, this ruling was a little bit of a surprise. I mean, it was absolutely correct in that it recognized that the law offers equal protection for LGBTQ Americans, a fact that should never have been in doubt. I also want to say on the floor today, we're going to have to continue to be on guard that this administration's judges will use the approach underpinning this ruling as cover to strip equal protection from other people in future rulings. When you get the wrong approach resulting in the correct ruling, we've got to be vigilant. Vigilant, vigilant, and more vigilant in fighting for the correct results again and again and again. The ruling came just a few days after the Trump administration tried to take America in exactly a different direction, announcing that it was greenlighting healthcare discrimination against transgender Americans. An ugly, shameful action to take. How cruel that the administration actually said, Senator Merkley, we're going to announce this during Pride Month. We're actually going to use Pride Month to be cruel. It was a reminder to a lot of people that the fight for LGBTQ rights didn't end with the victory on marriage equality. For every landmark ruling that moves the cause forward, there's somebody like Donald Trump who's always looking to see if they can drag the nation back to the days when discrimination was business as usual. Until Monday's ruling, employers in more than half the states were allowed to fire employees for their sexual orientation or their gender identity. That was in more than half the states, Mr. President. But that injustice is now a thing of the past. We can't count on this week's Supreme Court ruling against workplace discrimination to bring on the end of discrimination in other parts of life in our country. The Senate can't wait for any other court cases to move forward before we take real action on this floor. That's why my colleagues and I are here today. We want to call for the immediate passage of the Equality Act. If discrimination against LGBTQ Americans is illegal in the workplace, then it is illegal in housing. It's illegal in education. It's illegal in public services and more. That's what the Equality Act is all about. It's about recognizing the dignity and the humanity of LGBTQ Americans, and most importantly, enshrining it into the law. It's the next step that will move the cause forward, and there's bipartisan legislation that reflects the will of an overwhelming majority of the American people. The Senate ought to come together and pass it now. Justice Kennedy wrote, and I'll close with this because it sums up what's in my heart today, "The Constitution promises liberty to all within its reach. There's much to be done on delivering on that promise outlined by Justice Kennedy." So we're going to be back here on the floor of the Senate fighting for the passage of the Equality Act. Senator Stabenow was spot on. We ought to have done it today. And we're just going to be back here again and again and again in the weeks and months ahead until we have that promise of equality in every corner of the land. Mr. President, I yield the floor.
That was Oregon Senator Ron Wyden talking to fellow members of Congress about the Equality Act. The U.S. Supreme Court has blocked the Trump administration's attempt to end deferred action for childhood arrivals, also called DACA. That's the Obama-era program that protects hundreds of thousands of immigrants brought to the U.S. as children from deportation. The 5-4 ruling was written by Chief Justice John Roberts, who sided with the liberals on the court, Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Elena Kagan, Stephen Breyer, and Sonia Sotomayor. Roberts wrote in the majority opinion that the administration's justification for shutting down the program was not sufficient enough. He wrote, quote, "We do not decide whether DACA or its recession are sound policies. We address only whether the agency complied with the procedural requirement that it provide a reasoned explanation for its action." He did point out that the administration could try again to end the program by providing a lower court with better reasons for ending the program, a process which could end up taking months. It's the second time in a week that the Supreme Court, even with two of Trump's nominees, has ruled against the Trump administration. On Monday, the court said the Civil Rights Act protects LGBTQ Americans from job discrimination. In response, Trump tweeted, "Do you get the impression that the Supreme Court doesn't like me?" In Washington state, a dam removal is bringing new hope for the Northwest's fish and orcas. As Eric Tegedoff reports, the Nooksack River is crucial salmon habitat for the Northwest, and a dam is coming down to help them survive.
Construction crews have begun to remove the Middle Fork Nooksack Dam near Bellingham, restoring a crucial river for salmon. The project is decades in the making and has become critical as fish species in the Northwest dwindle. Stephen Day is project engineer for the City of Bellingham Public Works Department. He says it opens up 16 miles of spawning habitat for salmon, steelhead, and bull trout.
The project itself has been listed as the single most effective fish passage project in the Nooksack watershed for a period of over 15 years.
Restoring the river is important for the endangered southern resident orcas of Puget Sound, which have declined in numbers as salmon populations have dropped. Project partners include the Nooksack Indian Tribe, Lummi Nation, the organization American Rivers, and the state of Washington. Dam removal has required creative thinking. Over the past 50 years, the dam has been a vital part of Bellingham's water supply. But Day and the city have come up with a solution. He says the new system will be installed slightly upstream from the old dam and is a win-win for the city.
It will not create a waterfall or other step within the river and creates a passage issue, and will still provide for municipal water supply to the citizens of Bellingham.
American Rivers joined the project in 2017, getting the ball rolling on removal with funding from the Paul G. Allen Family Foundation. April McEwen with American Rivers hopes that can inspire other projects in the region.
That's just a tremendous story of hope, and also what we can do with our future. We can meet our own future needs better without creating so much impact on the life support systems that we all depend on.
The dam is scheduled for demolition in July. The Middle Fork Nooksack River is expected to flow freely in September for the first time in 50 years. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trust. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You- You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for two in-depth reports, one on St. Philip the Deacon Episcopal Church and another on Portland's eviction response. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. At 7, we'll hear popular education. Then at 8, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland. Tonight's weather, we'll see a few passing clouds, but generally clear skies, down to a low of 58. Tomorrow's weather will be mostly cloudy with a high of 87. Today in history, on this date in 1873, American suffragette Susan B. Anthony tried to vote in a U.S. presidential election, but as a woman, she was fined $100. The quote of the day is from Susan B. Anthony. She said, quote, "Men, their rights and nothing more. Women, their rights and nothing less." Vice President Joe Biden acknowledged the fifth anniversary of the tragic mass shooting at the historic Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. Iowa's governor says she will sign an executive order to restore the right to vote for Iowans with past felony convictions, and Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg makes announcements about political speech on the platform. Lily Bolke has these stories today in today's edition of 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
It was a hate unbridled, and it was poisonous, a poisonous expression of white supremacy that still infects our nation and many of our institutions.
5 years ago yesterday, a white supremacist shot and killed 9 parishioners at the historic Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. Former Vice President Joe Biden acknowledged the lives lost at a campaign stop in Philadelphia.
We know that grace alone is not enough. We have to put it to work.
Many activists want resources transferred to fund more of the non-criminal needs that currently fall to police to address. 50-plus liberal groups criticized Biden's past support for bills that contributed to racial disparities and urged him to take up the movement for Black Lives platform. Jalen Cavill with Black Lives Matter in Des Moines, Iowa, says their members, lots of young people, are often told about the importance of voting.
You know, join the Black Caucus. You know, electoral politics is the way to go, which is fine. I worked in electoral politics. I understand the value of that. But I also understand that you can't be preaching to everyone, oh, you need to vote, you need to vote, when 10% of Black people in this state don't have the right to vote.
Iowa is the last state to permanently bar people with past felony convictions from voting. Governor Kim Reynolds says she'll change that by executive order sometime before November. Betty Andrews, president of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP, urges Reynolds to make the change sooner rather than later.
When you're newly out of prison, maybe 40 years ago you got out of prison, but you've been denied for so long, it's going to take time for people to trust that system.
For years, the NAACP has advocated a constitutional amendment, harder to achieve and harder to dismantle, with no extra requirements or exceptions.
Thinking about the legacy of poll taxes and various ways that have been used to prevent the African-American community and other communities from voting, it is really an opportunity for people to know that they are part of this democracy.
Yesterday, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg announced their new voter information campaign, defended his platform's loose moderation of content, and revealed a new option that allows users to turn off ads from candidates, super PACs, or other groups sharing any information related to social, political, or electoral issues. Quite a lot of content. That's problematic for one it favors incumbents, says Jonathan Nagler from NYU Center for Social Media and Politics.
I sort of get that from a business model perspective, that Facebook likes their users to have a good experience. But from a perspective of, hey, you're a platform where people are receiving political information, they just made it harder for challengers. I don't see that as a good thing for American politics.
Reviewing John Bolton's book, The Wall Street Journal reports, Trump's conservative former national security advisor writes that the president asked China's Xi Jinping to help him win re-election, among other, quote, fundamentally unacceptable behavior, unquote. This, as warnings, continue about ongoing foreign interference. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Santa Fe's mayor has called for the removal of certain statues which Native people say glorify genocide. Native people praise Washington, D.C.'s mayor's call to change the Washington football team's name, and there are plans to rebuild after a fire to empower Native youth in the Twin Cities. With those stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The mayor of the city of Santa Fe, Alan Weber, on social media Wednesday, called for the removal of a Kit Carson statue, a Don Diego de Vargas statue, and a monument in the city. Grassroots Native groups and New Mexico tribes have long called for the removal, saying they glorify genocide. The effort follows the temporary takedown of Juan de Oñate statues in Albuquerque and one north of Española this week amid protests. The group, Three Sisters Collective, is planning an event Thursday in Santa Fe to call on the mayor and city council to follow through on the mayor's announcement. The National Congress of American Indians has praised D.C. Mayor Mariel Bowser's call to change the name of the Washington football team. Christine Trudeau reports.
This week, NCAI's President Fawn Sharp marked D.C. Mayor Bowser's remarks as, quote, a watershed development in Indian country's decades-long struggle to remove this and many other offensive and degrading Native-themed mascots from sports and popular culture, unquote. Mayor Bowser gave an interview with a D.C.-based radio station with R word in the title, where she said it's, quote, past the time for the team to deal with what offends so many people, unquote. Suzanne Harjo has been advocating for a name change for the past 25 years and says she appreciates Mayor Bowser's statement.
Perhaps at long last, there will be a way for her and the council to reach the very hard of hearing Mr. Snyder in a way that we have not been able to.
Daniel Snyder is the owner of the Washington football team, who has long refused the name change. The R word remains the worst thing a Native American person can be called in the English language, Harjo says.
Here's what it means when a lot of us who know our history, who have been infused with knowledge by generations of Native peoples, know and feel when we hear and see that word. Those are our ancestors who were skinned, who were literally, their skins were taken off them and presented to bounty payers who paid the bounty hunters. This is the kind of thing that happened to our relatives.
NCAI continue their call to all sports leagues, school systems, state and local governments, and businesses across the world to condemn and abolish these mascots. I'm Christine Trudeau.
The leader of a Native American center describes the loss of property to fire during riots in Minneapolis after the death of George Floyd and how they'll move forward with the center's work to empower Native youth. Rhonda Lavaldo has more.
The McGeezy Center served 500 Native American youth from the Twin Cities area. When a fire burned the roof off the brand new building, all of that came to a halt. President Kelly Drummer has been working hard to get it up and running.
The money that we've raised about $1 million probably today from our direct site GiveMen, GoFundMe pages, and others. Our plan is to rebuild either at the site or near our site.
The center served a lot of students with its new computers, equipment, and big spaces. They provided media training and job training. When asked how those students are doing, Drummer said they held an event so the students could talk about their feelings.
Everything they've ever known has kind of been wiped away. School, friendships, sports, activities, working within organizations, being able to participate in youth groups. Now, this injustice with George Floyd and then what's happened to their own community, it's like all these layers.
Drummer had a call with the governor of Minnesota, who is reaching out to all the Native organizations to ask what they need, which she hopes helps get the momentum going on rebuilding. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 18th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Piper McDaniel, Melissa Hood, and Annette Newell. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Volke, Antonia Gonzalez, and Eric Tegadoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you'd like to support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Churches and faith communities have long been places for people to gather, share, and even mobilize in support of common causes. In the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, churches played a large part in fueling and organizing for change. This is not so different in the modern era, with local faith organizations pushing for institutional change to the way that Black Portlanders are treated by the police. I spoke with the rector of St. Philip the Deacon Episcopal Church, the Reverend Dr. Maria McDowell, about the history of racism in the Episcopal Church and the role that modern faith communities can play in the current movement for racial justice. St. Philip the Deacon is a historically African-American church located in Portland that is part of the larger Episcopal Church, which is a mainline Protestant Christian denomination rooted in the Anglican Church. The Episcopal Church separated from Anglicanism once the United States gained its independence. Let's get into my conversation with Reverend Maria McDowell. Thank you so much for speaking with us today. Can you start out by telling us a little bit about the history of your church?
Sure. St. Philip the Deacon was started actually in 1911 as a specifically African-American parish within the Episcopal Diocese of Oregon. A lot of the members had come to Oregon by working on the train and were a part of other congregations. And actually, I think as they became a larger group of African-Americans in Portland, experienced a lot of tension around racism within congregations and their ability to participate in leadership. And so they were given permission to start a mission. It was actually called the Colored Mission by the diocese. And so in 1911, they started their own parish in Northeast Portland. And then they bought property and built a building at its current location at the corner of Knott and Rodney. And they've been there since then, and it's a parish that has had a lot of members who've been really active, professionally active, had lawyers, dentists, doctors that have been a part of it throughout its history, pretty active in civil rights work. Members helped start the NAACP and the Urban League here in Portland. Unthank Plaza, that Dr. Unthank was a member of the congregation. So it's been a congregation of pretty active African-Americans, active in social work and in politics around Portland since its beginning.
Yeah, I'm curious, can you speak to a little bit the history or the relationship between churches and movements for civil rights?
Between Episcopal churches?
Sure, yeah.
Sure. So I think it's a fraught history, to be honest. The Episcopal Church, really until the Civil Rights Movement, I would say, tried to, it presented itself as above the fray, as outside of politics, which I think now we would say there is no way to be outside of politics. That you actually are siding with existing political structures if you think that you're not really doing anything, or that you're simply allowing the status quo to continue if the status quo is acceptable. And so I think that up until the civil rights movement, the Episcopal Church as a denomination really saw itself as a part of existing legal and social structures in the United States. That really began to change with the civil rights movement in the South and the active participation of younger Episcopal clergy, white and black, in that movement, and that that changed how the Episcopal Church understands itself in relation to social and political structures. And you know, I don't think that in 1930 or 40 we would call the Episcopal Church a particularly progressive or liberal church on a political spectrum. Now, that is certainly the case. And I think that places like St. Philip provided kind of a haven for African Americans whose cultural and religious background actually was Episcopal, because a lot of them came from the islands, where the Anglican Church is a fixture, but were also committed to social justice within their neighborhoods. And so I think the parishioners at St. Philip were really active in civil rights. I think that relationship with other parishes has really depended on, frankly, the politics and the leadership of that particular parish. I think that right now there's a growing shift within the Episcopal Church at large, and certainly within within Oregon, to recognize that sort of a passive "we're against racism" isn't sufficient, that we need to be actively anti-racist. And I think that some of the folks at St. Philip's have been a part of that conversation and encouraging that. It's also an aging congregation, and so I think that there's right now that's a struggle. It remembers a lot of its history and participation in the civil rights and inviting other parishes and folks into that. But right now, you know, a lot of folks are 75, 80 years old and really can't be out protesting, but are supportive of that. So I think it's a, you know, I think there's kind of a fraught relationship between parishes and political stances, and how much as Episcopalians we want to challenge the status quo that's around us. And it really varies from parish to parish. And yeah, I'll leave it there. It varies.
And so in thinking about the current movement for racial justice, what role could the modern Episcopal Church, or even churches more broadly, play in that movement?
I think that depends on which churches you're talking about, to be honest. I think that the Episcopal Church has a lot to apologize for. We are a church whose infrastructure and wealth comes out of the racist slave trade, north and south. That's actually something that the Episcopal Church has wrestled with a lot recently. There's a curriculum now called Sacred Ground, which came out of, I can't remember the name of the woman, but she made the movie Traces of the Trade, in which she recognized that her family's wealth and participation in one of the oldest churches in Providence, Rhode Island, was entirely based on the slave trade. And out of that came an investigation of kind of the history of complicity with racist practices throughout the country. And so recently the Episcopal Church has committed itself to educating its primarily white members around what it means to be an anti-racist. I think that, so in a part, I think the Episcopal Church has a lot to apologize for, and it needs to recognize the ways in which its wealth and its status came at the cost of the way it's violated the rights and promises made to all people of color. I also think that it remains a fairly wealthy and powerful institution in the country, and as much as I don't like the reality of it, I do think that white people need to be on board to actually dismantle racism. And I am a white priest in a black congregation, so I think that probably affects my viewpoint. But I think that having members who are a part of local governments, I mean, there are Episcopalians in local Portland government, there are Episcopalians in the legislature, there are Episcopalians at all levels of sort of social and political power those, we need to use that power for anti-racist work. And sometimes that may mean we need to step down from those positions and we need to advocate that people of color hold them. But I think that, you know, whether we like it or not, all religious institutions in the United States still have a lot of influence and power. And we see that on the Christian right. I mean, we see that they have lots of influence and power and are pretty shameless about wielding that. I think that progressive organizations and institutions need to do that. I think a great example of that is actually the Poor People's Campaign that is currently being led by Reverend William Barber, and he's reinvigorating something that Martin Luther King was a part of as a faith-based active response to challenge the ways in which poverty is sort of deemed acceptable in our nation. So I think it's an important thing, but I think it really depends on what denomination and what group you're talking about. You know, I don't think that people at St. Philip have to apologize, but I do think that there are probably other Episcopal churches in our state that need to think more clearly about how they've benefited from, you know, the racist policies of being a white supremacist founded state.
Right. And so I'm curious about talking about different Episcopal churches and parishes. Apologizing is one thing that you noted as one action that they could take towards anti-racism. Are there other ones that come to mind for you?
Yeah, and you're right. That's fair. I don't think an apology is sufficient at all. You know, in the statement that St. Philip released, part of why it was written the way that it was is to acknowledge that communities of color and faith communities of color have actually been asking for very specific practical changes for a long time, and that we need to actually act. And I think a significant part of that action, especially for Episcopal churches, is to get behind the leadership and the work that has already been done by communities of color. We don't actually need to tell communities of color what they need. They know that. And they probably have a better sense of that than most of us who are white Episcopalians. And so getting behind that is really important. A part of that means listening better to our Latinx congregations. We actually have a number of them in the state. They too experience, for instance, police violence, fear of police checking on them due to immigration concerns. And instead of poo-pooing that or dismissing that, or, you know, we need to act to change policies. I think that's one way that we can do that. And then that we primarily need to act to change those policies that are being advocated for by organizations of color. And so that's, you know, as an example, that's why we wrote the St. Philip statement that we did, is it's not enough to say, hey, we think racism is bad, but we need to actually call our commissioners and call our leadership and say, here are the things that we'd like to change. And we support the work that's already being done by communities around us.
Right, and that faith communities have for a long time been a place for mobilization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's the other thing is, you know, the civil rights movement really was a faith-based movement in a lot of ways. Not all, I mean, whether it was Martin Luther King or Malcolm X, faith was a part of that. The religious structure of that faith might have been different, but frankly, religion motivates a lot of people still. And I think especially Judaism, Islam, and Christianity have such a sway in the U.S., and they are at core religions of compassion and solidarity with those who are being oppressed. And we need to actually take advantage of that as a part of our faith commitment and actually act on that in a way that pursues actual real change in the world around us.
Well, Maria, I want to thank you for speaking with us. Do you have any closing thoughts for our listeners before we wrap up?
I guess I would say that, especially since I think most listeners in Portland are not necessarily people of, are not people who are committed to a particular faith community, is I think that it's really important to both recognize the importance that faith can have in making change, but also call your faith communities to account. You know, it's not okay for us to just worry about what our Sunday morning worship looks like in the middle of a pandemic. It's really important that we are called to actually act on the values of our faith traditions. And sometimes we need to be reminded of that because we're afraid or we forget or it's uncomfortable. And I think that's really important that I think that faith matters, even if it's not shared. And I think that we need to be reminded to act on that faith for in solidarity with anybody who is oppressed, whether they're a person of color or they're queer or they're poor, you know, whatever that is, faith communities need to be reminded that that is the core part of our mission as people in the world.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time to speak with KBOO.
I appreciate having the time. Well, thank you very much, Althea.
That was Reverend Dr. Maria McDowell, the rector of St. Philip the Deacon Episcopal Church, a historically African-American church located in Portland. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Lucky to sit down today with musician, podcaster, writer, activist, and anarchist David Rovix to talk about the Portland Emergency Eviction Response, an important direct action happening in the city of Portland, Oregon. Welcome, David, and thank you so much for joining me virtually today.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
All right. Can you tell us a little bit about Portland Emergency Eviction Response?
It's very much just getting off the ground right now, but what we've got set up is basically a secure website where people can share their phone numbers with us. No other information is necessary, just phone numbers, and then they will get text notifications when we hear about an eviction that's taking place. And the basic idea of the response of eviction response, like in this direct action type of eviction response, is just that the eviction should be abolished as a means of resolving anything, you know, just like just along the lines of the defunding the police. It's very much the same principle that this should not be how issues get resolved in society, forcing people at gunpoint to leave their homes. So that's the idea it's rooted in a lot of history of rent strikes throughout this country and throughout the world, which often follow a certain pattern, which along the lines of when there's some kind of an eviction or other action by the police taking place somewhere, then people have a system of being notified. Traditionally, like in the 1840s, it was a tenant farmer blowing on the tin horn, and then the noise carrying through the hills of upstate New York in the case of the rent strike in upstate New York in the 1840s. But in other times, it's been a telephone tree or various other ways of getting the word out. But the text, I don't know if we're still calling it a text mob, but the text, the phenomenon of signing up for text messages, I think, is a pretty good way to kind of notify people of something that's happening quickly, so that they can hopefully drop everything and come to where the eviction is taking place. And it tends to be the case in many different instances that just a few dozen people showing up to an eviction can drastically change the course of events. And there's no guarantee. You know, it depends on a lot of different circumstances. But that's the idea. You could call it bearing witness to evictions, but it's also the fact is that observers influence the experiment in many cases. You know, whether or not people are committing direct action of any kind, or trespassing, or doing anything you know that the police deem to be illegal, which is also often part of similar kinds of actions, and you know, whether people, I mean, in the 1930s, and many people are talking about the 1930s because basically we're in a new depression, as many people are increasingly acknowledging in the mainstream media. In the 1930s, the councils of the unemployed were a powerful force in this society, and also the same kinds of thing as the councils of unemployed in the cities, it also existed among farmers in the countryside, that were mainly concerned with preventing evictions of people from their apartments and houses and their farms. And the means that they employed often involved, once if evictions were carried out, then people's belongings were taken back into their apartments. I mean, whether or not anything like that you know, can necessarily take place here, it's all conjecture, because I think, you know, I'm not the organization, I'm not the network, I'm just trying to set up the network and try to at least be able to have some kind of a system in place to be able to respond to local evictions. That's my only not very lofty goal, is to just set up a basic network.
So the emergency eviction response is about direct action. It's about stopping evictions in real time. It's about community coming together. What about landlords? Do you have any demands for any of them if they're out there listening?
What has driven the incredible increase in the cost of housing has been this sort of uncontrolled, deregulated structure after the financial crisis of these big banks buying up all of this property and buying up all these buildings. So, I mean, it's such a surreal. Anyway, yeah, if they're listening, if somebody's listening, capitalism has gone completely out of control, and this was before the pandemic. Your lobbyists are destroying this country. Your lobbyists have caused such a degree of corruption in the state legislatures across this country that they're not even capable, it seems, of governing on behalf of renters or other members of the working class. And ultimately, societies that become this stratified and this unstable fall apart. And that's what's going to happen unless we reverse course and drastically change the relations between the increasingly rich and the increasingly poor in this failed state called the United States.
Do you have any advice for people who are just now starting to get involved with what we previously termed radical politics?
I'm so loath to give advice because it's like, you know, don't listen to the old people necessarily, you know. But having said that, my only real advice, I think, would be seize the moment, because I mean, and this isn't just advice to other people, this is advice to myself too. It's advice to everybody, not just young people, but anybody involved with what's going on right now. Seize the moment, because even if this does continue to grow and become a larger social movement and develop even you know, all kinds of structures of organization that will make it bigger and stronger, even if all that happens, as I hope and actually expect it will, at some point that may stop being the case, and things may not be growing and getting bigger and stronger and more organized. And if it goes on long enough, the growing and the strengthening of the movement, it can be intoxicating, and it can feel like you're going to win, but and you may not win, but seize the moment, because it's when the window is opening that you have the best opportunity to open it further.
That's great advice from someone who doesn't want to give advice.
Thank you.
You're a father. You mentioned you're walking right now with a stroller. How do you raise radical kids?
Oh, I love that question. I mean, there's this brilliant woman named Naomi Aldort who wrote a book called Raising Our Children, Raising Ourselves. And if people are looking for a sort of a blueprint or, you know, a textbook on how to raise radical kids, then, you know, these books do exist, and there's really, really great stuff out there. And books are very useful in a lot of ways. You can really learn a lot from a book. But I think the best way to raise radical kids, I mean, somebody said the best thing I ever did as a parent was give my children my full attention. I don't even remember who said that, but I think that's really good advice. And don't teach them, just help them, provide them with structure and appreciate them and then let them do their thing. You don't need to teach them. They model everything from the world around them. The best thing you can do in terms of any kind of like teaching is modeling, and who you are and how you behave and how you interact with other people is what they're going to get out of you.
So lead by example.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. Where can people find more resources about Rent Strike, about Peer? How can they get involved?
Well, to sign up for text notifications, they just go to artistsforrentcontrol.org and then click on where it says Portland Emergency Eviction Response. And that's in terms of showing up for evictions that I eventually expect to happen. I mean, because this city and the county has done the best job of sort of kicking the can down the road of anywhere in the country, which is really good. It's just that it needs to be pushed further. And if they don't, if real reforms don't happen in terms of canceling rent and hopefully also deferring mortgages, speaking of small landlords, but you know, if that doesn't happen, then you know, there's going to be a wave of evictions, and we need to be able to be ready to respond to them. And so, that as far as that goes, as far as plans for direct eviction response, that's what I am trying to set up. But I would very much encourage people to be involved with the Portland Tenants United and other organizations that are representing tenants, and to just yeah, there's so many ways that people can be involved. I think actually, as much as it is maybe you can say maybe the internet has its severe limitations, but popular education is really important, because people need to be able to imagine how the world can be a different place. Otherwise, we can't. What are we going to do when we defund the police? You know, people have to be able to imagine what can society be like. How will it be structured? If you know, do things have to be this way? If you're poor, do you have to be poor? If you've gone generations without anybody being able to afford to buy a house, does that have to be how it is? And you know, does there have to be this kind of inequality? This kind, you know, how do we overcome things like historic, you know, multi-generational wealth existing in some white families and barely existing at all in black and brown families? You know, these kinds of questions need to be really tackled. And it's easy to say Black Lives Matter, but what are you going to do about it? You know, and you know, what are you going to do about the extreme inequality in the society, which is so much wrapped up around race and class? You know, you can't just only talk about you know, things like bias and personal growth and police who are members of fascist organizations, which is all a big problem and really serious. But what about the structural problems that continue to perpetuate the terrible schools that exist in so much of this country, and the lack of opportunity. We have very little social mobility in this country compared to many other countries. Like just about any country in Europe has better social mobility than we have here. And that's our this legacy of inequality that is perpetuated through racism and through the, once you already have inequality in so many ways, it becomes very hard to overcome, and actually it tends to perpetuate itself. It tends to get worse in many ways, as we could see with the last financial crisis as well. You know, that that increased the stratification of wealth, the way that the rich dealt with that crisis by buying up assets. And the Great Depression, they did the same thing. And they'll do it again now if we don't stop them.
David, is there anything else you'd like to say before we sign off?
Oh, I would just say that social movements can accomplish anything. So if anybody is feeling hopeless, you might have good reason to feel hopeless, but if a movement gets big enough and well-organized enough, it can potentially accomplish anything. And I'm not promising that that's going to happen, but it can happen, and the moment is looking very interesting in a lot of ways.
You've been listening to a conversation with David Rovics of the Portland Emergency Eviction Response. To find out more and get involved, go to artistsforrentcontrol.org.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.